end of Year of the Cure right here on AM 580 with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, of course, with Veritas Medical. Of course, check out the website, veritasmedical.com. Number to call, 771-1160 there at the clinic, 771-1160. And, of course, along the way, if you have any questions for the good doctor, feel free to give us a call at any time throughout the broadcast, 745-5800, 745-5800. You can always text in your question as well at 806-745-5800. Well, let me say good morning once again to Dr. Ben Edwards. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Wade. I'm very well. How are you?
Doing good. And then, of course, we have Melody sitting in, and you're going to want to talk allergies, I know. But
well,
he has a lot.
If he wants. Talk about what he wants to talk about.
Oh, I thought you were going to, like, you had all your medicines laid out, ready to go.
I already asked him that off air, so people wouldn't have to be bored with my ailments.
But apparently a lot of people having a lot of allergies right now. Something in the air that's really bothering a lot of people. Don't bother me. I'm lucky in that
just
regard.
Just the weak ones of us, Wade. You know,
I know
we can't hit.
I have great gut health.
Yeah,
exactly. Me and the girls are all sneezing, our eyes are watering, and he's like, "I don't know what's wrong with y'all."
I have great gut health. Yeah, you know, my gut's in great shape. Can you tell?
Must be all those vaccines you got in the army.
That's what it is. All those vaccinations I took from the military have really helped out here. So I'm bulletproof, you know. But nevertheless, some people really have a lot of problems with that, and I feel for you if you've got allergies. It's kind of brutal right now with all this rain and stuff. There's no doubt about it. So a lot of people having it. There you go. So,
well,
anyway.
And for those of y'all having it, what I told Melody was Dehist, which is a product from Orthomolecular, but the ingredients in it are quercetin, stinging nettles, and bromelain. Mm-hmm. And all three of those ingredients have been shown to be very effective with blocking the histamine release and blocking the histamine receptors. So different mechanisms of action. But they've put those ingredients head-to-head with Singulair, Zyrtec, Claritin, some of your traditional antihistamines.
Really?
And they've done well. You can use them in combination, too. But I really like Dehist from Orthomolecular because it uses all three of those ingredients. Now, you've got to do it as directed on the bottle, which is a loading dose for the first week to really get the levels up, the quercetin levels up where they need to be. But usually it'll work pretty good. I think that's their number one seller of all the nutraceuticals that company makes. That one sells the most because it's really pretty effective.
This really a good
Dr. one. Fit nasal spray I've been using too. It's got glycerin, colloidal silver, xylitol, the, how'd you say that? Quercetin?
Quercetin.
Quercetin. Peppermint oil, oregano oil.
That's kind of a spray, though, for a sinus clean-out,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, that's going to do a better job at killing sinus infections, the oregano oil, the silver, the xylitol. Xylitol is a sugar alcohol, and many of the bacteria that like to give us infections will actually grab onto that sugar molecule, the xylitol sugar molecule, and hold onto it instead of holding onto the sugar molecules that are in your mucus. So you're able to flush that out better.
But I just feel like it'll keep anything from turning into an infection.
Yeah, definitely. It's a good option. The oregano oil will cause a little sting or burn,
yeah, just a
usually.
Little.
So thus the name, OMG.
Yeah.
Spray.
Oh, my
yeah,
God.
It'll
get you.
It'll put a hair
I
in your
I love
chest.
It. I love it. That's awesome.
Well, I wanted to get into some other stuff today besides allergies.
Sure.
I was at a conference giving a presentation this weekend about our new Veritas Healthy Community concept. But where I started was with the ADA website, the American Diabetes Association's website, and their own definition
right.
of diabetes, saying that diabetes is a chronic progressive disease, which is not true. Now, I'm not calling the ADA liars necessarily. I think they're just ignorant and they're not fully up to date on what the current science is showing us. So the Pima Indians are a group of Native American Indians in southeast Arizona. And pre-World War II, there were zero cases of diabetes in that population group ever reported. And now 50% of that population is diabetic. So obviously something happened that caused the diabetes. And what happened was they started eating the standard American diet, which is high in grains and sugars. And when you eat carbs, you naturally spike insulin levels. And when you spike insulin over time, you become insulin resistant, and that's the root cause of diabetes, insulin resistance. Unfortunately, the ADA and our current medical education doesn't aggressively address the insulin resistance. We chase the blood sugar. We give pills that'll drop your blood sugar numbers, but we're not actually getting rid of the insulin resistance. Therefore, the diabetes stays with you forever. It's kind of like having a leg wound, and there's pus and redness and kind of gangrene setting in from all the bacteria festering in that leg wound. And you get a fever of 101 degrees that goes along with that. And you take Tylenol for the fever, and the fever will come down. So you're chasing that number, that temperature. And you're treating the temperature with a pill that brings that number down, brings the temperature down. But obviously, I mean, we all know that if you treated gangrene with Tylenol, eventually that disease is going to progress and progress and progress and kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fever is just a symptom. It's not the disease. It's not the cause. So, I mean, that makes perfect sense to every layperson and every doctor. You treat the bacteria with antibiotics, so then the infection goes away and the fever naturally will go away on its own. It's the exact same thing with diabetes. We end up chasing these high blood sugars. Your blood sugar is 180 or 200 or 300, so we'll give pills or insulin to bring that number down. But we're not addressing the cause of that high number, which is the insulin resistance. And actually, insulin and most of those pills make insulin resistance worse. So the treatment is making the cause of the disease worse. So no wonder it's a chronic progressive disease in our old way of thinking and in the American Diabetes Association's current way of thinking and most doctors' current way of thinking. But if you actually address the root cause of the gangrene, the leg infection goes away, you address the root cause of insulin resistance, and it goes away too. So patients, even on insulin, can be get off insulin and not be diabetic anymore and have normal blood sugars. I've seen this multiple times myself. Worst case I ever saw, a gentleman was on 250 units of insulin in the morning, 250 units at night, which is unheard of. I mean, I'd never seen anybody on that much insulin. Plus, he was on the oral agents too, I think three or four different pills for diabetes. And in 6 months, he was off all that, and his blood sugar was normal. And we see this over and over and over. And it's not just me. All the functional medicine doctors see this. Dr. Jason Fung, I think I mentioned last week, gives some great lectures on YouTube that explains how this works. So you address the insulin resistance, and your blood sugar normalizes. I mean, it's pretty simple. So the question that my audience this weekend had, and most people have, is, well, how in the world did we get here? And how in the world did the American Diabetes Association end up with this conclusion that this is just a chronic progressive disease? So I did some research and went back and looked at the history of medicine. Wanted to share a few of the things I found. First off, the AMA, American Medical Association, was founded in 1847, but 3 years prior to that, the American Institute of Homeopathy was founded. Homeopathy is a natural way of doing medicine, quite popular in the 1800s, started in, I believe, England, or could have been Germany. But anyways, in America, 1844, the American Institute of Homeopathy was founded. 3 years later, AMA was founded. So from 1859 to 1880, 5,000 homeopathic physicians graduated from U.S. medical schools. 5,000 from 1859 to 1880. So in the late 1800s, we had naturopathic doctors, we had homeopathic doctors, we had herbalists, we had chiropractors, we had doctors of osteopathy, or DOs, and then the doctors of allopathy, or MD. So we had all this variety of different ways to get educated and to treat patients, and most of the ways were more natural ways in the late 1800s. Louis Pasteur came along in 1861, came out with the germ theory, but right at the same time, one of his contemporaries, Claude Bernard, came out with his theory that the terrain is everything and the germ is nothing. So most people kind of forget about Claude Bernard, and everyone remembers Louis Pasteur and the germ theory. In a minute, I'll show you why that's so important. But that was 1861. Germ theory came out. 1899, the first drug came out. That's aspirin. Shortly after that, turn of the century, 1910, the Carnegie Foundation. They employed a gentleman, Alexander Flexner. they commissioned him to travel around the country and visit all these different schools, the naturopathic schools, the homeopathic, the herbalist, the MD, and the DO, and the chiropractor, all of them. And so he published this report, excuse me, in 1910. And basically that report said we needed to standardize our medical education. We couldn't have all these just whoever opening up a medical school and teaching whatever. It needed to be standardized. So his recommendation was to standardize it to the allopathic model or the MD model. So the Carnegies and Rockefellers got behind that report, which they funded, and decided to give a lot of donation and money to the MD schools. So the MD schools really took off. They built new labs and hospitals and schools and had all the support financially from the Carnegies and Rockefellers. of course, the Carnegies wanted to have a say-so in the curriculum, so they insisted on having somebody from Carnegie and Rockefeller Foundations to be on the board of these MD schools, so that was put in place also, so the curriculum could be influenced. And of course, there was some conflict of interest because the Carnegie and Rockefellers were into the chemical business, so it's the thinking and the curriculum and the treatment protocol started shifting to chemical-based, pharmaceutical-based therapies. So by 1923, the Flexner Report comes out in 1910. You know, and some people look at the Flexner Report and say, well, you know, that was really good. We needed to standardize things because there's just all kinds of, you know, non-standardized education going on out there. So there's kind of two camps. You know, this was a good thing, but then there's this another consequence of this report coming out was that all the homeopathic schools closed. 1923, there are only two homeopathic medical schools left. That was down from 22 in 1900. So in a matter of 23 years, 20 schools closed, only leaving two homeopathic schools left. By 1925, 10,000 herbalists were out of business. By 1940, 1,500 chiropractors were being prosecuted for quote-unquote quackery. So the first half of the 1900s, we really narrowed our education and the availability of different thought processes in regards to medical care. And it was all allopathic, MD, pharmaceutical, chemical-based was the big push in the early 1900s. And that was coinciding with the aspirin coming out in 1899. By the 1940s, when penicillin had such great success in World War II, and then Dr. Thomas Brown and Albert Sabin were a couple of doctors that were studying rheumatoid arthritis. And what these guys did was aspirate the joints of rheumatoid patients. So they would suck fluid out of the joints, like out of the knuckles of rheumatoid arthritis patients. What they found was mycoplasma, which is a type of germ, and so they treated that germ with tetracycline, an antibiotic, and these patients would get better over time. Their joint pain would resolve. So they had this theory that this rheumatoid arthritis was because of infectious agent, and treat it with an antibiotic and it would get better. But right at the same time, another colleague of theirs discovered cortisone, hydrocortisone. It's a steroid, and the body normally makes a little bit all day long, but they discovered this and gave it in a high dose in a pill form. And if anyone's ever taken steroids, you know, a Kenalog shot for allergies or prednisone for anything, you see a dramatic response, a dramatic reduction of the inflammatory symptoms that you're having. So these rheumatoid arthritis patients would have miraculous turnarounds in a matter of days when you gave them high dose steroids. So at that point, we had two different thoughts here. One is there's an infectious agent, and we give an antibiotic to kill the infection, and then the inflammation and rheumatoid goes away. Or this other thought process of these patients just need steroid. They're steroid deficient, so we'll give them steroid, and they'll be better. So everybody went that way because of the miraculous quick fix that the steroid gave. And people kind of forgot about Dr. Thomas Brown and Albert Sabin and what they found with the infectious cause of arthritis. So really what we're setting the stage here for, all the education got shifted to the MD schools. Aspirin and cortisone, penicillin, these were good successes. Take a pill for this ailment and you have a quick fix, a dramatic response. So we just moved into this age of thinking about miracle drugs and quick fixes and treat the symptom, not the cause. You know, get the dramatic effect. you know, give me a pill to fix it kind of mentality. So from the 1950s till current, that mentality has really been the dominating mentality. However, which you can't see on the radio in my presentation, I went through all the statistics in chronic disease from 1950 until now. And let me just tell you, it's an exponential rise of almost every disease, from cancer to heart disease to autoimmune disease to autism, I mean, allergies, asthma, eczema, you name it, across the board an exponential rise. Not a gradual, slow, steady rise from 1900 until now, but an exponential rise. And it's most of them start from between the 50s to the 1970s and 80s is when you really see the dramatic rises. So, you know, really all the doctors trained currently, I mean, if you're a doctor now in 2016, I mean, the only thing you've ever known was this allopathic quick fix, give me a pill to fix things. So when you have that mindset and you're not looking at root causes, obviously you're only going to treat symptoms. You know, reflux is another great example. I'd say 98% of our patients with reflux are symptom-free within a month or two, because obviously the cause of reflux is the valve between the stomach and the food pipe, your esophagus, is not working right. I mean, if it were squeezed tight like it should be and closed, acid couldn't come up into your esophagus where you feel it and it burns and it hurts and it bothers you. So it's just a valve problem. You fix that valve and you're good to go. Of course, in med school, we just learned to block the acid production. Now, if you got acid symptoms, let's just stop your acid production. So that's, again, treating a symptom, not a cause. And we could go just right down the line. But diabetes is a great one, and I can talk more about that after we talk to this caller, maybe.
Okay. Good morning. Welcome into the show.
Yeah, I heard you talking about the esophagus, and I was just wondering what causes that esophagus to stop working.
Okay. The valve that's between the esophagus and the stomach is called the lower esophageal sphincter. So sphincter, it's just this muscle valve. So when the muscle squeezes, the valve shuts, and it keeps the acid down in the stomach where it needs to be, which, by the way, stomach acid levels should be so high that your pH is a 2, 1 to 2. So it's very, very acidic. So you can't really make too much stomach acid. It's impossible to get more acidic than a 1 to 2. So it's not too much acid that's the problem. The trigger for that valve to close and stay shut so that your acid stays down, the triggers for that have to do with having enough stomach acid. When you have a really low pH, a pH of 1 or 2, which is from plenty of stomach acid, that triggers a signal to the nerve that innervates that muscle of that valve to squeeze. So basically the stomach acid's interacting with the nerve that controls that valve and telling that valve to fire off and squeeze and stay shut. So if you don't have enough stomach acid, that signal is lost. Another mechanism is the stomach acid is there to kill germs, because every bite of food you eat has some amount of germs on it. Even though we wash and clean our food and try to be sterile and all that, there's just germs on our food. There's mold, fungus, parasites, bacteria. But the stomach acid kills all those bugs. So if you don't have enough stomach acid, your pH in your stomach is not low enough, some of those bugs will overgrow. And when these germs overgrow in the stomach and the upper part of your small intestine, these germs start to metabolize the food inappropriately. They start breaking the food down, and part of that breakdown process results in gas production.
Yeah, and the food never gets to the stomach. That's what I'm talking about. It doesn't pass through the esophagus. It won't go down.
Yeah, if you've got a stricture or a narrowing in the esophagus, that's usually from scar tissue that's built up from years and years and years of acid coming up into the esophagus because your valve wasn't working for so long. So once you have a narrowing or a stricture, some people call it a spider web kind of deal, but it's basically scar tissue. So once you're already that far down the road, you have to go in with a scope and break that scar tissue up and expand that narrowing so that you can pass the food. But that's a result of acid coming up into the esophagus over a long period of time, typically. But again,
it seems like the muscles just won't squeeze it down. That it just doesn't enter. I don't know, like you said, said the sphincter muscle, something like that. It kind of squeezed it down, but this doesn't work. The food just won't pass, and that's what.
Have you had an endoscopy? Have you had a scope down your esophagus to look around?
I think it's not me. It's my wife. She has to drink shakes. She can't. Her food just won't go down. And matter of fact, she was in the hospital 9 days because she had a great big wad there at about mid-size. There, they had to siphon all that food that would not pass through. And
okay.
After that, then they put her on the shakes, and now she's drinking about 2 or 3 shakes a day, and that's all she can eat because the solid food just won't pass.
Yeah.
I don't know what the medical term is. Well, it just won't go down the esophagus. That's the only way I can say.
Yeah.
So she can't eat. She can't even chew up a cookie. She can't even chew up an apple. She can't, you know, nothing soluble pass down through that.
Right. Well, I imagine they did scope her, I would think.
Yeah,
if there was a blockage or a narrowing, I'm sure they took care of that. So if it's an actual motility, I mean, if she's having, it sounds like she could be having problems with the nerves that control the muscles of her swallowing reflex.
Yeah, the muscles don't seem to work is what my, that's what I think is, because it just won't. In other words, the food, when you chew it up and goes, it just won't move.
Yeah. Well, in that case, it could be more of a neurological problem. The nerves that tell those muscles to do what they're supposed to do aren't working properly, or it could be even higher up above the nerve, more into your into the brain.
Well, and the doctor doesn't seem to have any cure, because she's got an appointment here, I know, next Monday for the doctor, and he's just going to check on her, but he's seen her before, and there's nothing really he can do.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem to be any cure for it. I was just wondering.
Well, whenever it's a neurological issue, I definitely want to have a good chiropractor involved, where he can look at the vertebra that are involved. There's certain levels in the spine that tend to be involved with our GI tract and our swallowing mechanisms. So I would definitely want to have a good chiropractor involved to confirm that subluxation is not there. Subluxation is just a shifting of the vertebra that impede neurological flow. Electrons flow through our nervous system. That's how we communicate. Our brain communicates to the different organs. I mean, every muscle, every organ is controlled by the central nervous system. So that's one thing to consider.
Any chiropractor you recommend?
Oh, there's a number of good ones in town. Dr. John Hodnett's a great one. Dr. Jonathan House. Dr. Jason Helton. I like all those guys.
I'd start there,
and then after that, if that doesn't improve it, I would consider doing some micro.
I'm wondering why the doctors that had her in there after 9 days in the hospital, you know, wouldn't have recommended that. That's what I don't understand.
Well, in medical school, we aren't taught about chiropractors. In fact, we're kind of looked down on them. So you're not going to get much outside-the-box thinking from traditional medical advice, unfortunately. But Dr. Jerry Tennant's a doctor in Colleyville, and he's an ophthalmologist by training. He actually invented the LASIK laser eye surgery techniques. A really smart guy. But he got sick himself and wasn't able to get better by seeing the top neurologist in the world, really, at Harvard and everywhere else. So he had to go to an integrative doctor to get better. And now Dr. Tennant really preaches microcurrent, which is a way to work on different organ systems in the body, but it's through electricity, it's through electrons, and oftentimes in a situation like this, when the muscles and the nerves just aren't firing off right, I consider microcurrent therapy with Dr. Tennant.
Yeah, it seems to be something that comes on after years and years of, I don't know, eating wrong or something.
Well, our body gets our raw materials to build cells that work right. We get these raw materials from our diet. So you're right. If you're not eating right for a long period of time, you deplete all your pantry of the vitamins, minerals, fatty acids, amino acids that the body uses to build new cells. All of our cells are dying all the time. You know, your gut cells die every 4 days.
But it seems like the enzymes are the secret, but nobody ever talks about them too much because that's, it seems like that's what you get in the fresh stuff.
Yeah.
When they can it, you know, they cook it in the cans, it kills it all. So.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, even just picking stuff, I mean, the moment you pick something off the vine, vitamin C levels and other vitamin levels start to diminish in a matter of hours. So you pick it up.
Probably the microwave is the worst thing to use when you're cooking with because it kills everything.
The microwave.
Listen, I appreciate it. I wish there was some magic thing I could do, give my little old lady because she eat no shakes and she just deteriorating day by day.
One thing I'd recommend for you is go look at your little lady's shake. Look at the sugar content or see what sweetener they're using. If it's an artificial sweetener like aspartame or sucralose, I wouldn't recommend that. Or if they're just using straight sugar and the sugar content per serving is in the double digits, that's way too much sugar. So that's one thing for sure.
She puts a big old heaping of spiritine. Stuff that you get at the health food store, and I think it's silver spiritine or something like that.
Well, as long as it's not Splenda or NutraSweet, then you're good. But shakes, there's some good healthy versions of shakes, but your typical over the counter, you know, Boost and Ensure, too much sugar or artificial sweeteners. So at least do that for her.
I think that's why when she puts that bluebell stuff in there, that's plenty of sugar.
Oh, yeah, I don't know about that.
That thickens it up, too.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We'll take a quick break. We'll come right back. Stick around. We got more to go with You're the Cure right here on AM 580 with Dr. Ben Edwards.
Vitamins Plus is a full-line health food store located inside Drug Emporium on the corner of 82nd Slide Road. They have one of the largest gluten-free selections in Lubbock. If they don't have what you're looking for, then it can be special ordered for you. They are Texas-owned and operated for over 20 years. Vitamins Plus carries many locally grown and produced products in the store. Good for you groceries at great for you prices. That's Vitamins Plus, 82nd Slide Road. Come by and see us today. We're visiting with Dr. Flippin with Exodus New Beginnings. You can always check out the website, ExodusNB.com. Go there, check it out. Dr. Flippin, tell us about chelation therapy and why IV chelation therapy is better than oral chelation therapy.
Well, first of all, I'd like to tell you, Wade, about chelation, what it is. And basically, it is an agent that pulls heavy metals out of your body. Heavy metals get stored in your bones and your organs. And so that's what chelation is. Basically, the IV chelation is a lot more effective because you get a higher dose. So the oral chelating agents only have a tenth of the dose of an IV chelation. So you would have to do 10 times more oral chelations, plus the fact that they're only 23% absorbed. So do the math. At 23%, it's 40 times longer.
Oh, yeah. And we all know that we're exposed to environmental toxins and a lot of heavy metals and fillings in our teeth. I mean, we've got it all over the place. And this really helps to combat diseases related to those heavy metals, right?
Exactly. And one of the diseases is coronary artery disease.
Wow, yeah.
The heavy metals actually cause inflammation, which starts the cascade of coronary artery disease.
Be sure to visit the new location at 7711 Woodrow Road. That's 7711 Woodrow Road. Or call 863-3903. That's 863-3903. You can always visit the website, exodusnb.com.
Listen to your body. It may be telling you it's missing something. When we're missing omega-3s, we can feel run down, stiff, achy, or have a hard time focusing and handling stress. Omega-3s are vastly deficient in the American food supply, and we can't achieve optimal health without them. Nordic Naturals fish oils provide a convenient way to get the omega-3s you need and deliver industry-leading purity, freshness, and taste. Visit Natural Health Market at 4414 82nd Street in the Village Shopping Center.
At Smoothie King, wheatgrass juice is very popular with our health-conscious customers. Why is wheatgrass juice so good for you? Well, wheatgrass juice helps cleanse the body of toxins, hence the potency of just 1 ounce. Wheatgrass, ounce for ounce, has more vitamin C than oranges, more vitamin A than carrots, and a healthy dose of other vitamins, too. Wheatgrass assists in building endurance and athletic performance by supplying the cells, tissues, and muscles with extra oxygen. It's a complete protein, containing all the essential amino acids. Wheatgrass has a high mineral content. Magnesium, calcium, potassium, and iron are all available when you drink wheatgrass juice. It also contains hundreds of enzymes, which assist digestion and metabolism. Studies suggest that 1 ounce of wheatgrass juice has the vitamins and minerals of 2.5 pounds of green leafy vegetables. Get by Smoothie King today on the corner of Memphis Avenue and 19th Street. For optimal health, try wheatgrass juice at Smoothie King today. Welcome back into You're the Cure right here on AM 580 with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, Veritas Medical. Of course, Veritas Medical, you can always check out the website, veritasmedical.com, or call our clinic directly, 771-1160, 771-1160. Integrative Holistic Medicine, family practitioner. Of course, along the way, if you have any questions about your health, we're talking today about the history of health in the country, which I find fascinating. I've just been... I haven't interjected anything in that first half of the show because I thought...
We're just taking it all
in. Like, wow, I didn't recognize or realize that that's going on. And so, again, if you have any questions about anything, 745-5800, 745-5800. But that first segment, Doctor, was interesting because, correct me if I'm wrong, you explained it very succinctly and accurately about what has happened in our healthcare system. And now we're bringing it back down to where I think that, would it be fair to say that here we are in the 21st century that other alternatives are starting to have that breakthrough moment? Not just your clinic, but others out there that are looking at this and say, well, why can't we walk and chew gum at the same time? I mean, yes, there is going to be place for pills in some cases. I get that. You've talked about, well, if you cut your arm off, you know, we got the best surgical, and you blow a knee out, yeah, we'll fix your ACL, MCL, whatever. I mean, we've got some great technologies out there, but I think there's this crossover that I think is starting to take place where maybe in medical schools in the country itself, where as demand increases from patients saying, well, there's got to be alternatives to this, right?
Right.
And I think maybe that we're starting to understand this as a society. We're still slow, but it's increasing, correct?
Yes. Well, yes, it is increasing for sure. And I think there's two reasons as to why. First one is because we're so sick. I mean, it's becoming so obvious that what we're doing just isn't working. I mean, I throw these statistics up there, and I'm going to quote from my autism slide. In 1975, we're at 1 in 5,000. 1985, 1 in 2,500. By 1995, it's 1 in 500, and then it's this exponential rise. And in 2009, we're at 1 in 110. The latest stat from the CDC was in 2014. It was 1 out of 68.
Yeah.
However,
of autism.
Yeah, 1 out of 68 kids born now on autism spectrum. However, there's even a more current, it's not from CDC, but it was from a nationwide parent poll that is, as best as I could tell, was a very accurate poll, was it 1 in 45. So
kids born today with autism, 1 in 45.
Correct. So we went from 1 in 5,000 when I was born in 1974, 75, to where we are today. So, and that's just one disease. But you overlay all the different diseases and very similar rates of increase. So that's part of it is we're just so sick. Everyone's starting to realize, man, we are a sick country. I mean, I put a slide up on the on pharmaceuticals, how many pharmaceuticals were taken, and it's unreal. In the age range between 0 and 11 years old, 14.1% of that group is on one chronic drug, 4.6% is on two chronic drugs, 2.7% are on 3 to 4 chronic drugs. This is 11 years old and under.
Wow.
But when you go to the 12 to 19-year-olds, 17% of those kids are on a drug, 6.9 are on two drugs, and 4.8 are on 3 to 4 drugs in the 12 to 19-year-old.
That's unbelievable.
And, of course, you get into the 20 to 59 age range, and you're on a lot more. You get 60 and over. 80% of the population's on a drug. 12% of them are just on one drug. 36% are on 5 or more drugs. So, I mean, everybody's sick. Disease is getting worse.
It's a big business.
People are starting to notice it. And that's part of the driver. And the other driver is the economics. We're obviously going bankrupt paying for this sick care. So those two things together are getting us to a place of, hey, let's look at something else.
Oh, wow. Let's go to the phones. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Hi, my name's Robin, and I have a 17-year-old son who has been diagnosed with cyclic vomiting syndrome, and I was just wondering if I could get some information on holistic or integrative medicine side of things.
Okay, cyclic vomiting syndrome is just a label, obviously. It's a description of what's going on. It's a description of symptoms. And the current mindset that we all have, doctors and patients, is tell me the exact cause of this problem and give me that fix, where with this particular syndrome and many syndromes, it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not a, oh, here's the cause. It's this exact thing, and here's what you do. So there could be multiple factors involved here. But we don't... How our clinic functions, and I think most functional medicine docs would probably go along this line, is we're not even going to focus on cyclical vomiting syndrome. We don't focus on any disease. All we're going to do is interview the patient, spend 1 to 2 hours figuring out what is out of order in this person's life, in their diet and in their lifestyle, and then let's bring order to that. The things that we know bring the nutrients in that the body needs to function properly. Let's just normalize all that. And then we sit back and see what happens. So I'm going to make some, you know, guesses here. One of the things that causes normal GI motility, I mean, if food's sitting in the stomach and you're refluxing that up or vomiting that back up, there could be decreased motility. The food's just not emptying out of the stomach. It's not progressing through the small bowel, and it's not going all the way through like it should be. Motility is a nerve issue, but it's also a stomach acid issue. It's a low pH of the stomach that causes the stomach to empty, causes the gallbladder to squirt out its juices and enzymes, causes the pancreas to squirt out its juices and enzymes, and triggers the whole upper motility. Just a normal stomach pH. And that's a very simple thing, and you would think we wouldn't overlook that, but I would almost guarantee all doctors overlook that very simple thing of let's ensure there's no normal stomach acid, because that's the way God designed the stomach to work, all the valves to open and close properly, and for the intestines, the muscles of the intestines to start to squeeze to cause peristalsis to go properly. So that's an example of one of the things we would look for, is clues in the history, in the interview, of not enough stomach acid, and then we would support those stomach acid pumps. Unfortunately, one of the common things to put these patients on are anti-acid medicines, just, you know, throwing something at it. Let's just try this, and they end up on Nexium or something like that. Instead of actually looking at how did God design the GI tract to work, and let's support all those native functions. So that's what we would do, and I think most integrative guys would do, is make sure we have normal, the normal architectural and physiology of the GI tract going on. So I don't have an herb or a supplement or like some set protocol of do this and that syndrome goes away. It's a real individualized approach based on the patient's, you know, interview and their history and their story.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your help. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate the call.
And that's the tricky part of this, is we're so trained, and I'm not saying this caller necessarily, but in general we're trained to... we have this name, this label, this diagnosis. There's got to be, you know, what's your natural fix to that? tell me the herb or the sub, let me go to the health food store and buy this thing and it'll fix me. Or usually it's a multifactorial issue. There's usually multiple things out of order. Maybe there's not enough magnesium and zinc and iodine. Those are minerals that the parietal cell needs. The parietal cells are the stomach acid pumps.
But do you run tests for that? I mean, do you, I mean, as you run your battery of blood work and stuff, do you kind of look at the baseline of where the patient's at, I guess?
Those kind of tests to see what the mineral levels are, those are more expensive tests. We save those for our non-responders. So patients that are with us for a few months and don't respond, then we have to start ordering these deeper tests.
Okay.
But in the interest of finances for our patients, we don't typically start there. We do a initial blood panel that's very reasonably priced, and it's given us a broad look at some of the basic stuff, CBC, CMP, your metabolic function, your electrolytes, your kidney and liver function, your sugar levels, your inflammatory markers, stuff like that, insulin levels. So we do blood work, but we do more basic stuff that gives us some basic information. The more detailed stuff, like a intracellular mineral level, which a lot of these minerals are intracellular, like magnesium. 90% of your magnesium's inside the cell. So if you just go and get a blood test for magnesium, it's really kind of pointless because it's not telling you what the intracellular levels are. So that's a special test we do from SpectraCell. It's about $300. No insurance covers it that I know of. So you could spend easily $2,000 on lab work if you did all the really detailed, I mean, they're good labs, but most patients actually don't need it. And that's where we probably differ from a lot of functional medicine clinics. Most functional medicine docs are trained to draw this array of pretty extensive blood tests that are very, I mean, it's useful. It's real helpful. I mean, if we get that on all our patients, it'd be great. But what I found was it's too expensive. Most patients can't do it. And really, at the end of the day, it didn't change what we did. We were going to do these basic things anyways, and 90% of patients get better on the basic things. So, to answer your question, we could do that, but we typically don't.
Unless the basics are not working.
Right.
Then we have to go play Dr. Sleuth again and try to figure out why and go from there. So that makes sense. And I think that's being good for the patient, because in that way you're not walking into a situation where you're like, okay, it's going to cost you $3,000 to get started kind of stuff just on tests.
Right.
I mean, or something outrageous like that.
Yeah, and it reinforces the mindset of you're going to find the one thing that's wrong with me on this blood test, and then you can fix me based off of that. And that's the wrong mindset. And most people come into our clinics, you know, had been to a lot of doctors, and the blood tests say I'm normal, but I feel awful. I mean, that's a very typical thing, too.
Yeah, right.
So there's so much more to taking care of a person than the blood test. It really is the interview. You've really got to be a detective and use your brain and, you know, just have a thoughtfulness about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have time. In conventional medicine, you don't have time for that. You get 7 minutes for a visit, so no doctor can really practice the art of medicine anymore.
That's the problem with the old doc-in-the-box theory. And therein lies back to our conversation before the caller, which was you see all of these rates, these incidents of problems that have just skyrocketed to the moon, and we as a society, as in the healthcare industry, have been saying, well, okay, take a pill.
Yep.
Take this, it'll cure that symptom.
Yep. Well, it's when you treat a symptom like we started at the beginning of the show with, I mean, everybody knows if all doctors were treating gangrene with Tylenol, that our rates of death from gangrene would be very high.
Yeah.
And would be skyrocketing. There'd be no end in sight, and it'd be labeled a chronic progressive disease that's going to eventually kill you. And, you know, all that's true. It's going to kill you. But the reason it would be is because you're just giving Tylenol. You're just treating the symptom of fever. You're not treating the cause, which is the bacteria. And that goes to the diabetes. I mean, diabetes is just absolutely off the chart, especially if you use a more strict definition of diabetes, which I do, an A1C of 5.3 or higher. Most doctors would call 5.3 to 6.0 or 6.5 normal, but damage is being done even at those slight elevations of blood sugar. So anything above a 5.3 on your hemoglobin A1C, which is your 3-month blood sugar average, which we get on every single patient, not just on our diabetics, but if you're above a 5.3, you can't handle your sugar. You are insulin resistant. And insulin resistance is the root cause of diabetes. So to me, there's no pre-diabetes or whatever. Either you have insulin resistance or you don't, period. You're either pregnant or you're not. There's no in between. So all this pre-diabetic stuff, I don't really go with that either.
But how do you know if you're just an average Joe sitting out there with no indications of diabetes? Like in my case, mm-hmm. I've never taken that test. But yeah, I mean, I don't eat the best either. I know my diet's a little jacked up, but I do exercise. But I don't know if I'm quote unquote pre-diabetic or what would be some symptoms to say, hey, you need to watch out.
You're not going to have symptoms except, I mean, I guess excess fat. That'd be the main. I mean, that's a symptom of insulin resistance.
Well, who doesn't have excess fat?
Exactly my point.
I mean, come on.
They're diabetics, pre-diabetics, and insulin resistant. If you lumped all those people together, that'd be 80 to 90% of the American population. Now, they're not all fully diagnosed as diabetic yet, but they're all on what I call the spectrum of metabolic syndrome. So to know if your fuse has been lit. You know, before the bomb goes off of the diabetic actual diagnosis by your doctor, when you've been insulin resistant for 5 to 10 years by the time you're diagnosed by your doctor. But to figure this out, get an A1C. If you're above a 5.3, you're insulin resistant. Or draw at the same time, get into fasting insulin level. And if your fasting insulin level is above a 2, then I would consider you insulin resistant. Now, the lab level would say, you know, maybe you can be up to a 5 on your fasting insulin, but if you're fasting, you shouldn't be making any insulin. If you got insulin hanging around in your body, you're insulin resistant. So fasting insulin less than 2 and an A1C less than 5.3, you're pretty good. And check that every single year. And as soon as you see that start to rise, get on it. I mean, reverse your insulin resistance, which the way you reverse that, don't eat foods that spike your insulin.
That's true.
Because insulin is what causes insulin resistance.
But look, there's I've got a great example of like my little brother, although he's not biologically related to me. And I think genetics does play a big role some into this stuff as we talk about. And that could be a whole other show about genetics.
It's about 5% of it, genetics, in my opinion.
Do you really? I think it's a little more than that, but you're the doctor, so I'm going to go with it.
Even the latest cancer stats are showing 90 to 95% of all cancer, it's diet and lifestyle.
Well, okay, but the...
But the Pima Indians, great example. Pima Indians, zero diabetes.
Okay.
Post-World War II, 50% of the Pimas are diabetic. It's the same genes. They haven't shifted their genetics.
Right, but we talked about this on a show a few weeks ago about how genetics, though, certain genetics can actually help you and protect you better than other genetics.
Yes, but it's the epigenetics above the genes that really matters.
Okay.
You can have the genetics for insulin resistance, but if you don't produce... If you don't eat foods that jack your insulin
That's
up, it
true.
Doesn't matter. Those insulin-resistant genes can be there all day long.
And I don't think
matter.
That you can go, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you can also take in your body mass index into
no.
consideration either. Because
BMI is just a really kind of a waste.
Do you think so? I think so it is too because, look, my BMI right now, I guarantee, is 24%.
You need percent body fat.
And I'm at 24 and the Army says, well... If you go to 25, then you're on the fat man program.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay, whatever.
It doesn't take into account muscle and bone density, all that kind
right.
of stuff.
Right, right. So my thought was, well, because my little brother, who had to go to Duke University, they have a great fat farm there apparently, he went in there at 450 pounds and lost a tremendous amount of weight on the Duke University plan, like 200 and something. And he's kept it off because he eats right. It's what they taught him there at Duke to do this kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
And he's managed to hold the weight off and, stop drinking alcohol and eating the
Well, then that just kind of disproves your theory about genetics.
No, I'm saying that the whole time he went through this process, he never was diabetic, even though he was 450 pounds. My point being is that a lot of people see a really over-obese person like that and say, oh, that guy's definitely going to be diabetic. And sometimes they're not.
I would love to have seen his A1C and his fasting insulin because to diagnose diabetes at Duke and at all the other universities and doctor's offices, you have to have a fasting blood sugar above 146. They don't even look at the fasting insulin. I mean, Duke may have. I'd like to see the numbers. But that's how the ADA says to diagnose it, fasting of 146 or any time above a 200 or after a glucose challenge test. I think it's 126, I want to say. But anyways, there's certain levels of blood sugar rise that you use to diagnose diabetes. which I'm not even looking at that. I'm looking at your insulin levels, because insulin is the hormone that tells your sugar to get out of the blood and get into the cell. So if you're starting to build up a little bit of too much sugar in the blood, not enough to be called a diabetic, just a little too much, then your body responds by producing more and more insulin. Mm-hmm. So that insulin will move that sugar into the cell. But when it's too much sugar and too much insulin, insulin works like we've talked about before. All hormones work like a key into a keyhole. The keyhole for insulin gets bent out of shape. So your insulin key can't fit in and turn the lock to open the door to let the sugar into the cell.
Okay.
So it's that keyhole issue again that we talk so much about. When that keyhole isn't accepting that key, that's called insulin resistance. But the primary thing that bends that keyhole out of shape is this chronic spike of insulin all day long. So you start your day with a glass of skim milk, OJ, and Kellogg's Total or Special K or whatever, a grain, a processed grain, skim milk, which turns into sugar, OJ, which is nothing but sugar, and whole wheat toast, let's say. Just right away, you've just spiked your sugar, therefore your insulin, and then that insulin will drop your sugar, and about 10 a.m. you're hungry again, so you eat peanut butter crackers. So the crackers spike your insulin. And then you drink a Coke or even a Diet Coke. That spikes your insulin. Then you have some whole wheat pasta for lunch or a Subway sandwich, and all that bread spikes your insulin. Then you have some Sun Chips with that Subway sandwich, because Sun Chips are healthier. Well, that's a grain. It spikes your insulin. So we're having these grain and sugars all day long, and it's spiking the insulin all the, and it's that chronic up and down roller coaster, spike insulin, spike insulin, spike insulin, that actually causes the keyhole for insulin to get bent out of shape. The chronic exposure to insulin is what drives insulin resistance. So how do you reverse that? Obviously, you drop the roller coaster down. You drop those spikes of insulin down. So how do you do that? You avoid the foods that cause your insulin to spike, and those foods are sugar and grains that turn into sugar. So we eat fat instead. And this is going, we'll talk about this next week. Back in the 1700s, there was a doctor who figured this out: eat fat to stay skinny. And so 1700s, 1800s, this was just well known. The first diet book ever written was this guy. He was an overweight British physician who figured this out. You just eat fat, it makes you feel full, and you don't eat too much, and you don't gain weight. Anyways, what he didn't really realize in what he was addressing was the insulin spikes. When you eat fat and protein, you're not going to spike insulin. So I'm not saying you can't ever eat sugar or ever eat a carb, but it needs to be minimal. It needs to be low. And through the 1800s, early 1900s, up to about 1940, everyone knew this. Everyone knew it.
Is that they knew it, or just that's the way the diet was?
People just knew it, because that's, like the housewives in the 1800s, 1900s, they knew to fatten them up. You feed the fatty carbs. And we knew it with the pigs and the cows. Before you slaughter them, you need to fatten them up. So we feed them all this grain to fatten them up.
Corn, that's true.
And stuff. I mean, it was just something we observed in nature. We observed when we eat more fatty carbs, starches. I say fatty because it makes you fat. When you eat these carbs, starches, and sugar, it spikes your insulin. Insulin tells you to store fat. So not only does it make you insulin resistant and lead to the diabetes, but it also tells you to store fat. Your body can store energy in two forms. It can store it as glycogen, which, think of that as just a bunch of glucose or sugar molecules stacked up to each other, kind of like pearls on a pearl necklace. You stack up enough sugar molecules, that's called glycogen. We can store energy that way, and that's in the liver. You store glycogen. Or you can store energy as fat. So think of it as like a refrigerator and a freezer. So the refrigerator, you get home from the grocery store, you can put food in there real easily, take food out easily, eat it that night. Energy in, energy out of that refrigerator real easily. Your freezer, it's harder to get to. It's down in the basement. It's a trunk freezer. It's full of all this frozen food. You put food in there for deep storage to get it out. It's kind of cumbersome to get it out, and you got to thaw it out and do all this stuff. That's your fat. So the body can store in the refrigerator as glycogen or in the deep freezer as fat. But normally what happens when you consume energy, you consume food, if it's fat and protein and you don't get an insulin spike, that energy is processed as glycogen, and you burn that thing off. It's the starches, especially the processed wheat, corn, and rice. But it's the carbs or starches. If you eat too much of that, you fill up your refrigerator really, really quickly because there's a lot of glucose molecules in there. So all of a sudden, you just filled up your entire refrigerator with glycogen, and there's no more room in your fridge. And you've got to store it in the fat. But to even open your freezer and store it as fat, you have to have insulin. Insulin's the key that opens your freezer store so that you can push all that extra glycogen. If you fill up your fridge and all the sugar glycogen molecules there's too many of them. They're spilling out of your fridge into your bloodstream, spilling out of your liver into your bloodstream. You store it as fat. But you can't store it as fat unless there's insulin. So, I mean, it's just so obvious when you get your blinders off in the way we've been taught for the last 50 years that eating fat makes you fat. It's calories in, calories out. That's totally not true. It's not about calories in and out. It's all about hormones. The insulin is the fat storage hormone. We'll go into this maybe later next week. We have more time to get into the details of it. But I'll bring some of the history of how we got to where we are now as an obese country with all this diabetes. And when you have diabetes, you get more heart attack, more stroke, more blindness, more autoimmune disease, more cancer, more dementia. I mean, it talks about it on the American Diabetes Association's website. Diabetes is a chronic progressive disease. It increases your risk of heart attack, stroke, cancer, dementia. And that's the thing. When I tell doctors that come to our clinic to shadow, and I tell them, just, you know, start with the easy stuff if you want to. Just get people to quit eating carbs and sugars. Just get them on fat and protein and watch what happens. Their diabetes goes away. But be careful, because that diabetic who comes back to you in 3 months and he's off his meds and he's not diabetic anymore, his blood sugars are normal, he's also going to tell you, hey, doc, by the way, my arthritis is better. And by the way, my psoriasis cleared up. And by the way, I'm not having migraines anymore. And by the way, everything else tends to get better too. There's a relationship between all of this. It's not just diabetes as a disease, quote unquote, that's all by itself. It's associated with all these other problems because all these root causes are the same. When you have inflammation as a root cause, sugar, grain, insulin, all these things create inflammation. It brings disorder to the body. So it's pretty cool. As a functional medicine doctor, you start to see when you address one core issue like insulin resistance, so many things in the body start to normalize and these other problems, symptoms, or diseases, we call them, start to normalize too. I mean, it's great. It's incredible. And that's why every doctor, according to Mark Hyman at Cleveland Clinic, who's head of the Institute of Functional Medicine, he said every doctor will practice this way 20 years from now. And I agree wholeheartedly. If every doctor knew it existed right now and there was money to be made in it, they'd all be doing it today. But because they don't know it exists, and then number two, they don't know how to make it work from a business model standpoint, they hesitate to go there. It's just hard to believe, first of all. I'm having dinner with a doctor this Friday here in town. We'll see where he's at, but I know probably where he's at is, this can't be true. I mean, that's what every doctor tells me when I tell him, type 2 diabetes, it's not a chronic progressive disease, it's a reversible consequence. And they look at me like I'm from Mars. You know, we're just so brainwashed into this thinking that all these diseases just kind of poof out of nowhere, or it's all genetics or whatever. No, it's not. It's the last 50 years all these diseases came hardcore like they've come. So it's a consequence of something we've done. And part of what we've done is treat symptoms instead of causes. We're treating the temperature instead of the gangrene.
And part of it is the fact that our food industry is a powerful lobby.
Yeah.
And they don't care about your health. They care about getting you addicted to their substance.
Yep.
And it's impregnated with all these bad things that we put in our body thinking we're putting in the right things.
Sugar's more addictive than cocaine. The studies prove that. You can look that up, Google that. There's PET scans, brain scans of when people eat sugar, it lights up the addiction center more intensely than cocaine and heroin and all the other stuff. But yeah, once the low-fat mantra came out in 1950, they pulled the fat out. Well, fat is what makes stuff taste good. No one's going to eat stuff that doesn't have fat, so you got to load it up with artificial sweeteners or sugar or other flavor enhancers. Mm-hmm. Well, all these things interact with your neurochemistry in your brain and cause you to be addicted to it. So it's just this snowball effect of, yeah, the food's huge. The fact we aren't producing food that actually nourishes our body. We're producing food that tastes good and gets us addicted to it, but it's nutrient depleted. And that's some of my other slides. 1950 and on, mechanized farming started, or the man-made fertilizers started and pesticides and all herbicides. And the mineral content, I mean, this graph that I show is just incredible. Phosphorus, magnesium, zinc, all the micro minerals just plummet. They go to almost nothing when you add in these modern farming techniques. So maybe that can be another discussion too.
All right. Dr. Ben Edwards, everybody, again, check him out, VeritasMedical.com, VeritasMedical, all one word, .com. You guys call our clinic here locally, 771-1160, 771-1160. And, of course, you've been listening to You're the Cure right here with Dr. Ben Edwards, M.D., with Veritas Medical. Dr. Edwards, we appreciate it. We look forward to seeing you back here next Monday on the show on You're the Cure right here on AM 580. Have a wonderful week, sir.
Thank